to come crawling here for Salgeska's charity. Seems only fair that she should require most of them to earn it. Charity? They have a roof over their heads, food to eat, and the chance of money. Those that earn the gold prizes seem to have no trouble taking their coin and leaving. 1 in 80 wins a Solari, my lord. No doubt more money than they've ever seen at once in their lives. And for the other 79, that gold is just a promise, holding them here day after day, week after week, default after default. And those that die because the demons get out of hand, what good is gold or the promise of gold to them? Anywhere else, it would be plain murder. It's Azaguia that takes them from the arena floor, not you or I or anyone mortal, fair white. Genrusa's brows were furrowed and his cheeks were reddening. And yes, anywhere else, it might be plain murder. But this is Salon Corbeau, and they're here of their own free will, as are you and I. They could simply choose not to come, and starve and die elsewhere. Please, I have seen the world, Master Fairwhite. I might recommend it to you for perspective. Certainly some of them must be down on their luck, but I wager you'd find that most of them are just hungry for gold, hoping for an easy break. Look out at those on the arena floor now. Quite a few young and healthy ones, aren't there? Who else might be expected to make the journey here on foot without extraordinary luck, my lord Genrusa? I can see there's no talking sense to sentiment, Master Fairwhite. I'd thought you coin-kissers from Emberlane were a harder lot than this. Hard, perhaps, but not vulgar. Now mind yourself, Master Fairwhite. I wanted a word because I was genuinely curious about your disposition. I think I can see now what it stems from. A bit of advice. Salon Corbeau might not be the healthiest place to harbour your sort of resentment. My business here will be shortly concluded. All for the better, then. But perhaps your business at the amusement war might be curtailed even sooner. I'm not the only one who's taken an interest in you. Lady Salgeska's guards are sensitive about discontent, above the arena floor as well as on it. I could leave you penniless and sobbing, whispered the voice in Locke's head. I could have you pawning your piss-buckets to keep your creditors from slitting your throat. Forgive me, my lord, I will take what you say most seriously, muttered Locke. I doubt that I shall trouble anyone here again. 8. On the morning of Locke's 9th day in Salon Corbeau, the Beaumondaines were finished with his chairs. "They look magnificent," said Locke, running his fingers lightly over the lacquered wood and padded leather. "Very fine as I had reason to hope. And the additional features?"
"Built to your specifications, Master Fairwhite, exactly to your specifications."
Loris stood beside her father in the Beaumondaine workshop while 10-year-old Parnella was struggling to brew tea over an alchemical hearthstone at a corner table covered in unidentifiable tools and half-empty jars of woodworking oils. Locke made a mental note to smell any tea offered to him very carefully before drinking. "You have outdone yourselves, all of you."
"We were, financially inspired, Master Fairwhite," said the elder Beaumondaine.
"I like building weird things," Parnella added from the corner.
"Heh, yes, I suppose these would qualify." Locke stared at his suite of 4 matching chairs and sighed in mingled relief and aggravation. "Well, then, if you'd be so kind as to ready them for transport, I shall hire 2 carriages and take my leave this afternoon."
"In that much hurry to leave?"
"I hope you'll forgive me if I say that every unnecessary moment I spend in this place weighs on me. Salon Corbeau and I do not agree.
Locke removed a leather purse from his coat pocket and tossed it to Master Beaumondaine.
An additional 20 solari, for your silence, and for these chairs to never have existed. Is this clear?
I'm sure we can accommodate your request. I must say your generosity is...
A subject that needs no further discussion. Humor me now. I'll be gone soon enough.
So that's all, said the voice in Locke's head. Stick to the plan. Leave this all behind and do nothing and return to Tal Vahrar with my tail between my legs. While he and Jean enriched themselves at Requin's expense and cheated their way up the luxurious floors of the Sin Spire, on the stone floor of Lady Saljeska's arena the defaults would go on, and the faces of the spectators would be the same day after day, children tearing the wings from insects to laugh at how they flailed and bled, and stepping on one every now and again.
"Thieves prosper," muttered Locke under his breath. He tightened his neckcloths and prepared to go summon his carriages, feeling sick to his stomach.
Chapter 5. On a Clockwork River. 1. The glass-fronted transport box erupted out of the Mon Magisteria's waterfall once again and slid home with a lurch just inside the palace. Water hissed through iron pipes, the high gates behind the box slammed shut, and the attendants pushed the front doors open for Locke, Jean, and Meraine. A dozen eyes of the Archon were waiting for them in the entrance hall. They fell in, wordlessly, on either side of Locke and Jean as Meraine led them forward. Though not to the same office as before, it seemed. Locke glanced around from time to time as they passed through dimly lit halls and up twisting staircases. The Mon Magisteria was truly more fortress than palace. The walls outside the grand hall were devoid of decoration, and the air smelled mainly of humidity, sweat, leather, and weapon oils. Water rumbled through unseen channels behind the walls. Occasionally they would troop past servants who would stand with their backs to the wall and their heads bowed toward their feet until the eyes were past. Meraine led them to an iron-reinforced door in a nondescript corridor several floors up from the entrance. Faint silver moonlight could be seen rippling through an arched window at the far end of the hall. Locke squinted and realized that a stream of water from the palace's circling aqueducts was falling down the glass. Meraine pounded on the door 3 times. When it opened with a click, allowing a crack of soft yellow light into the hall, she dismissed the eyes with a wave of her hand. As they marched away down the corridor, she pushed the door open slightly and pointed toward it with her other hand.
"At last! I might have hoped to see you sooner. You must have been away from your usual haunts when Meraine found you."
Stragos looked up from where he sat, on one of only 2 chairs in the small, bare room, and shuffled the papers he'd been examining. His bald attendant sat on the other with several files in hand, saying nothing.
"They were having a bit of trouble on the inner docks of the Great Gallery," said Meraine as she closed the door behind Locke and Jean. "A pair of fairly motivated assassins."
"Really?"
Stragos seemed genuinely annoyed.
"What business might that be in relation to?"
"I only wish we knew," said Locke. "Our chance for an interrogation took a crossbow bolt in the chest when Meraine showed up."
"The woman was about to stick one of these 2 with a poisoned knife, Protector. I thought you'd prefer to have them both intact for the time being."
A pair of assassins. Were you at the Sin Spire tonight?"
"Yes," said Jean.
"Well, it wouldn't be Requin, then. He'd simply have taken you while you were there. So it's some other business. Something you should have told me about before, Costa?"
"Oh, begging your pardon, Archon. I thought that between your little friends, the Bonds Magi, and all the spies you must have slinking about at our backsides, you'd know more than you do."
"This is serious, Costa. I aim to make use of you. It doesn't suit my needs to have someone else's vendetta on my hands. You don't know who might have sent them?"
Truthfully, we have no bloody clue.
You left the bodies of these assassins on the docks?
The constables have them by now, surely, said Mirrain.
They'll throw the bodies in the midden deep, but first they'll inter them at the death house for a day or two, said Stragos. I want someone down there to have a look at them, note their descriptions, plus any tattoos or other markings that might be meaningful.
Of course, said Mirrain.
Tell the officer of the watch to see to that now. You'll know where to find me when you're finished.
Your will, Archon.
Mirrain looked as though she might say something else, then turned, opened the door, and hurried out.
You called me Costa, said Locke, when the door had slammed closed once again. She doesn't know our real names, does she?
Curious. Don't you trust your people, Stragos? Seems like it'd be easy enough to get your hooks into them the same way you got them into us.
I'll wager, said Jean, that you never take up your master's offer of a friendly drink when you're off duty. Eh, Baldy?
Stragos' attendant scowled, but still said nothing.
By all means, said Stragos lightly, taunt my personal alchemist, the very man responsible for me getting my hooks into you, not to mention the preparation of your antidotes.
The bald man smiled thinly. Locke and Jean cleared their throats and shuffled their feet in unison, a habit they'd synchronized as boys.
You seem a reasonable fellow, said Locke, and I, for one, have always found a hairless brow to be a noble thing, sensible in every climate. Shut up, Lamora. Do we have the people we need, then?
Stragos passed his papers over to his attendant.
Yes, Archon, 44 of them, all told. I'll see that they're moved by tomorrow evening.
Good. Leave us the vials, and you may go.
The man nodded and gathered his papers. He handed two small glass vials over to the Archon, then left without another word, sliding the door respectfully closed behind him.
Well, you two, Stragos sighed. You seem to attract attention, don't you? You're certain you've no idea who else might be trying to kill you? Some old score to settle from Camor?
There are so many old scores to settle, said Locke.
There would be, wouldn't there? Well, my people will continue to protect you as best they can. You two, however, will have to be more circumspect.
That sentiment is not exactly unprecedented, said Locke.
Confine your movements to the Golden Steps and the Savrola until further notice. I'll have extra people placed on the inner docks. Use those when you must travel.
Gods damn it, we cannot operate like that. For a few days, perhaps, but not for the rest of our stay in Tal Vahrar, however long it might be.
In that, you're more right than you know, Locke. But if someone else is after you, I can't let it interfere with my needs. Curtail your movements, or I'll have them curtailed for you.
You said there'd be no further complication of our game with Requin.
No, I said that the poison wouldn't further complicate your game with Requin.
You seem pretty confident of our good behavior for a man who's all alone with us in a little stone room, said Jean, taking a step forward. Your alchemist's not coming back, is he? Nor Mirrain?
Should I be worried? You've absolutely nothing to gain by harming me.
Except immense personal satisfaction, said Locke. You presume that we're in our right minds. You presume that we give a shit about your precious poison, and that we wouldn't tear you limb from limb on general principle and take the consequences afterward.
Must we do this?
Stragos remained seated, one leg crossed over the other, a mildly bored expression on his face.
It occurred to me that the two of you might be stubborn enough to nurse a bit of mutiny in your hearts. So listen carefully. If you leave this room without me, the eyes in the hall outside will kill you on sight. And if you otherwise harm me in any way, I repeat my earlier promise.
I'll revisit the same harm on one of you tenfold while the other is forced to watch.
You, said Locke, are a goat-faced wad of slipskinner's shit.
Anything's possible, said Stragos. But if you're thoroughly in my power, pray tell me, what does that make you?
Downright embarrassed, muttered Locke.
Very likely. Can you, both of you, set aside this childish need to avenge your self-regard and accept the mission I have for you? Will you hear the plan and keep civil tongues?
Yes. Locke closed his eyes and sighed. I suppose we truly have no choice.
Jean?
I wish I didn't have to agree.
Just so long as you do.
Stragos stood up, opened the door to the corridor, and beckoned for Locke and Jean to follow.
My eyes will see you along to my gardens. I have something I want to show the two of you, while we speak more privately about your mission.
What exactly do you intend to do with us? Asked Jean.
Simply put, I have a navy riding at anchor in the Sword Marina, accomplishing little. Inasmuch as I still depend on the Priori to help pay and provision it, I can't send it out in force without a proper excuse.
Stragos smiled.
So I'm going to send you two out onto the sea to find that excuse for me.
Out to sea? Said Locke.
Are you out of your Take them to my garden, said Stragos, spinning on his heel.
2. It was less a garden than a forest, stretching for what must have been hundreds of yards on the northern side of the Mon Magisteria. Hedges entwined with softly glowing silver creeper vines marked the paths between the swaying blackness of the trees. By some natural alchemy, the vines shed enough artificial moonlight for the two thieves and their guards to step easily along the gravel paths. The moons themselves were out, but had now fallen behind the looming 15-story darkness of the palace itself and could not be seen from Locke and Jean's position. The perfumed air was humid and heavy. There was rain lurking in the creeping arc of clouds enclosing the eastern sky. There was a buzzing flutter of unseen wings from the darkness of the trees, and here and there pale gold and scarlet light seemed to drift around the trunks like some fairy mischief.
"Lantern beetles," said Jean, mesmerized despite himself.
"Think on how much dirt they must have had to haul up here to cover the elderglass deeply enough to let these trees grow," whispered Locke.
"It's good to be a duke," said Jean. Or an archon.
At the center of the garden was a low structure like a boathouse, lit by hanging alchemical lanterns in the heraldic blue of Tal Varar. Locke heard the faint lapping of water against stone, and soon enough saw that there was a dark channel perhaps 20 feet wide cut into the ground just beyond the little structure. It meandered into the darkness of the forest garden like a miniature river. In fact, Locke realized, the lantern-lit structure was a boathouse. More guards appeared out of the darkness, a team of four being half-led and half-dragged by two massive black dogs in armoured harnesses. These creatures, waist-high at the shoulders and nearly as broad, bared their fangs and sniffed disdainfully at the two thieves, then snorted and pulled their handlers along into the Archon's garden.
"Very good," said Stragos, appearing out of the darkness a few strides behind the dog team. "Everything's prepared. You two come with me. Sword Prefect, you and yours are dismissed."
The eyes turned as one and marched off toward the palace, their boots crunching faintly on the gravel underfoot. Stragos beckoned to Locke and Jean, then led them down to the water's edge. There a boat floated on the still water, lashed to a little post behind the boathouse. The craft seemed to be built for four, with a leather-padded bench up front and another at the stern. Stragos gestured again for Locke and Jean to climb down into the forward bench. Locke had to admit it was pleasant enough,
settling against the cushions and resting his arm against the gunwale of the sturdy little craft. Stragos rocked the boat slightly as he stepped down behind them, untied the lashing, and settled on his own bench. He took up an oar and dipped it over the left gunwale.
"Tannen," he said, "be so kind as to light our bow lantern."
Jean glanced over his shoulder and spotted a fist-sized alchemical lantern in a faceted glass hanging off his side of the boat. He fiddled with a brass dial atop the lantern until the vapors inside mingled and sputtered to life, like a sky-blue diamond casting ghosts of the lantern's facets on the water below.
"This was here when the Dukes of the Therin Throne built their palace," said Stragos. "A channel cut down into the glass, 8 yards deep, like a private river. These gardens were built around it. We Archons inherited this place along with the Mon Magisteria. While my predecessor was content with still waters, I have made modifications."
As he spoke, the sound of the water lapping against the sides of the channel became louder and more irregular. Locke realized that the rushing, gurgling noise slowly rising around them was the sound of a current flowing through the river. The bow lantern's reflected light bobbed and shifted as the water beneath it undulated like dark silk.
"Sorcery?" asked Locke.
"Artifice, Lamora."
The boat began to slide gently away from the side of the channel, and Stragos used the oar to align them in the center of the miniature river.
"There's a strong breeze blowing from the east tonight, and windmills at the far side of my garden. They can be used to drive water wheels beneath the surface of the channel. In still air, 40 or 50 men can crank the mechanisms by hand. I can call the current up as I see fit."
"Any man can fart in a closed room and say that he commands the wind," said Locke. "Though I will admit, this whole garden is more elegant than I would have given you credit for."
"How pleasant to have your good opinion of my aesthetic sense."
Stragos steered them in silence for a few minutes after that, around a wide turn, past hanging banks of silver creeper and the rustle of leaves on low-hanging branches. The smell of the artificial river rose up around them as the current strengthened. Not unpleasant, but more stale and less green, somehow, than the scent of natural ponds and rivers Locke recalled.
"I presume this river is a closed circuit," said Jean.
"A meandering one, but yes."
"Then, forgive me, but where exactly are you taking us?"
"All in good time," said Stragos.
"Speaking of where you're taking us," said Locke, "would you care to return to our earlier subject? One of your guards must have struck me on the head. I thought I heard you say that you wanted us to go to sea."
"So I do, and so you shall."
"To what possible end?"
"Are you familiar," said Stragos, "with the story of the Free Armada of the Ghost Wind Isles?"
"Vaguely," said Locke. "The pirate uprising on the Sea of Brass," mused Jean. 6 or 7 years ago, it was put down."
"I put it down," said the Archon. 7 years ago, those damn fools down in the Ghost Winds got it into their heads to make a bid for power. Claimed to have the right to levy taxes on shipping on the Sea of Brass, if by taxes you mean boarding and plundering anything with a hull. They had 12 fit vessels, and 12 more or less fit crews."
"Bonaire," said Jean. "That was the captain they all followed, wasn't it? Lorella Bonaire."
"It was," said Stragos. "Bonaire and her basilisk. She was one of my officers, and that was one of my ships before she turned her coat."
"And you such a pleasant, unassuming fellow to work for," said Locke.
"That squadron of brigands hit Nicora and Velvirazzo and just about every little village on the nearby coast. They took ships in sight of this palace and hauled sail for the horizon when my galleys went out to meet them. It was the greatest aggravation this city had faced since the war against Camor in my predecessor's time."
"I don't recall it lasting long," said Jean.
half a year, perhaps. That declaration was their downfall. Freebooters can run and skulk well enough, but when you make declarations, you usually end up in battle to uphold them. Pirates are no match for real naval men and women when it's line against line on the open sea. We hammered them just off Nicora, sank half their fleet, and sent the rest pissing their britches all the way back to the Ghost Winds. Bonaire wound up in a crow's cage dangling over the midden deep. After she watched all of her crew go in, I cut the rope that held her up myself. Locke and Jean said nothing. There was a faint, watery creak as Stragos adjusted the course of their boat. Another bend in the artificial river was looming ahead. "Now that little demonstration," the Archon continued, "made piracy a fairly unpopular trade on the Sea of Brass. It's been a good time for honest merchants since then. Of course, there are still pirates in the Ghost Winds, but they don't come within 300 miles of Tal Vahrar, nor anywhere near Nicora or the coast. My navy hasn't had anything more serious than customs incidents and plague ships to deal with for nigh on 3 or 4 years. A quiet time. A prosperous time."
"Isn't it your job to provide just that?" said Jean.
"You seem a well-read man, Tannen. Surely your readings must have taught you that when men and women of arms have bled to secure a time of peace, the very people who most benefit from that peace are also the most likely to forget the bleeding."
"The Priori," said Locke. "That victory made them nervous, didn't it? People like victories. That's what makes generals popular. And dictators."
"Astute, Lamora. Just as it was in the interests of the merchant councils to send me out to deliver them from piracy," said Stragos, "it was in their interest to wring my navy dry soon afterward. Dividends of peace. They paid off half the ships, put them up in ordinary, loosed a few hundred trained sailors from the muster rolls, and let the merchants snap them up. The taxes of Tal Vahrar paid to train them, and the Priori and their partners were happy to steal them. So it was, and so it is, with the Sea of Brass at peace, the Marrows squabbling, Lashane without a navy, and Carthane far beyond the need to even consider one. This corner of the world is calm."
"If you and the Priori are so very unhappy with one another, why don't they just run you out of funds completely?"
Locke settled back against his corner of the boat and let his left hand hang far over the gunwale, trailing in the warm water.
"I'm sure they would if they could," said Stragos. "But the charter of the city guarantees me a certain minimal budget from general revenues. Though every finicker and comptroller in the city is one of theirs, and they contrive some damned elaborate lies to trim even that. My own ledger folk have their hands full chasing after them. But it's discretionary funds they won't cut loose. In a time of need, they could swell my forces with gold and supplies at a moment's notice. In a time of peace, they begrudge me every last centira. They have forgotten why the Archonate was instituted in the first place."
"It does occur to me," said Locke, "that your predecessor was supposed to sort of dissolve the office when Camor agreed to stop kicking your ass."
"A standing force is the only professional force, Lamora. There must be a continuity of experience and training in the ranks. A worthwhile army or navy cannot simply be conjured out of nothing. Tal Vahrar might not have the luxury of 3 or 4 years to build a defense when the next crisis comes along. And the Priori, the ones who prattle the loudest about opposing dictatorship and civic guarantees, would be the first to slip away like rats, loaded down with their fortunes, to take ship for whatever corner of the world would give them refuge. They would never stand or die with the city. And so the enmity between us is more than personal, for my part."
"While I've known too many grand merchants to dispute your general idea of their character," said Locke, I've had a sudden sharp realization about where this conversation has been going.
As have I, said Jean, clearing his throat. Seems to me that with your power on the wane, this would be a terribly convenient time for new trouble to surface somewhere out on the Sea of Brass, wouldn't it?
Very good, said Stragos. 7 years ago, the pirates of the Ghost Winds rose up and gave the people of Tal Verar reason to be glad of the navy I command. It would be convenient if they might be convinced to trouble us once again, and be crushed once again.
Send us out to sea to find an excuse for you. That's what you said, said Locke. Send us out to sea. Has your brain swelled against the inside of your skull? How the screaming fucking hell do you expect the two of us to raise a bloody pirate armada in a place we've never been and convince it to come merrily die at the hands of the navy that bent it over the table and fucked it in the ass last time?
You convinced the nobles of Camor to throw away a fortune on your schemes, said Stragos without a hint of anger. They love your money. Yet you shook it out of them like ripe fruit from a tree. You outwitted a bondsmage. You outwitted Kappa Barsavi to his very face. You evaded the trap that caught your Kappa Barsavi and his entire court.
Only some of us, whispered Locke. Only some of us got away, asshole.
I need more than agents. I need provocateurs. You two fell into my hands at an ideal time. Your task, your mission, will be to raise hell on the Sea of Brass. I want ships sacked from here to Nikora. I want the Priori pounding on my door, pleading with me to take more gold, more ships, more responsibility. I want commerce south of Tal Verar to set full sail and run for port. I want underwriters soiling their breeches. I know I might not get all that, but by the gods, I'll take whatever you can give me. Raise me a pirate scare, the likes of which we haven't had in years.
You are cracked, said Jean.
We can rob nobles. We can do second-story work. We can slide down chimneys and slip locks and rob coaches and break vaults and do a fine spread of card tricks, said Locke. I could cut your balls off, if you had any, and replace them with marbles, and you wouldn't notice for a week. But I hate to tell you that the one class of criminal we really haven't associated with ever is fucking pirates.
We're at a bit of a loss when it comes to the particulars of making their acquaintance, added Jean.
In this, as in so much, I'm well ahead of you, said Stragos. You should have no trouble making the acquaintance of the Ghost Wind pirates, because you yourselves will become perfectly respectable pirates. Captain and first mate of a pirate sloop, as a matter of fact.
3. You are beyond mad, said Locke after several moments of silent, furious thought. Full-on barking madness is a state of rational bliss to which you may not aspire. Men living in gutters and drinking their own piss would shun your company. You are a prancing lunatic.
That's not the sort of thing I'd expect to hear from a man who genuinely wants his antidote.
Well, what a magnificent choice you've given us. Death by slow poison or death by insane misadventure.
Come now, said Stragos. That's also not the sort of thing I'd expect to hear from a man with your proven ability for slipping out of extremely complicated situations.
I'm getting a bit annoyed, said Locke, with those who praise our previous escapades as an excuse for forcing us into even riskier ones. Look, if you want us to run a job, give us one within our field of experience. Isn't it broad enough for you? All we're saying is that we don't know the first bloody thing about wind, weather, ships, pirates, the Sea of Brass, the Ghost Wind Isles, sails, ropes, weather, ships.
Our sole experience with ships, said Jean, consists of getting on, getting seasick, and getting off.
I'd thought of that, said Stragos.
The captain of a criminal crew must have, above all other things, charisma, leadership, a sense of decision. Rogues must be ruled. I believe you can do that, Lamora, by faking it if necessary. That makes you the best possible choice in some respects. You can fake confidence when a sincere man might be inclined to panic. And your friend Jean can enforce your leadership. A good infighter is someone to be respected on a ship.
Sure, great, said Locke. I'm charming, Jean's tough. That just leaves all the other things I named.
As for the nautical arts, I will provide you with an experienced sailing master, a man who can train you in the essentials and make the proper decisions for you once you're at sea, all the while pretending the orders come from you. Don't you see? All I'm doing is asking you to play a role. He'll provide the knowledge to make that role convincing.
Sweet Venaportha, said Locke. You really intend for us to go out there, and you genuinely wish us to succeed?
Absolutely, said Stragos.
And the poison, said Jean. You'll just put enough antidote in our hands to allow us to roam the Sea of Brass, as we will?
Hardly. You'll need to call at Tal Varah once every 2 months. My alchemist tells me that 62 to 65 days is really as far as you should push it.
Now wait just a damn minute, said Locke. It's not enough that we'll be clueless sailors masquerading as hardened pirates, trusting another man to make us look competent, or that we're going to be out risking God's know what at sea, with our plans for Requiem postponed. Now you expect us to be tied to Mother's apron strings every 2 months?
It's 2 or 3 weeks to the Ghost Winds, and the same time back. You'll have ample time to do your business each trip, for however many months it takes. How closely you wish to shave your schedule is, of course, your own concern. Surely you see that it has to be this way.
No, Locke laughed. Frankly, I don't.
I'll want progress reports. I may have new orders and information for you. You may have new requests or suggestions. It makes a great deal of sense to stay in regular contact.
And what if we chance across one of those patches of, damn, Jean, what are they called? No wind whatsoever?
Doldrums, said Jean.
Exactly, said Locke. Even we know that you can't presume a constant speed with wind and sails. You get what the gods send you. We could be stuck on a flat ocean 50 miles from Tal Varah on day 63, dying for no reason at all.
Remotely possible, but unlikely. I'm well aware that there's a great element of risk in the task I'm handing you. The possibility of a vast return compels me to play the odds. Now, speak no more of this for the time being. Here's what I've brought you out to see.
There was a golden ripple on the black water ahead, and faint golden lines that seemed to sway in the air above it. As they drew closer, Locke saw that a wide, dark shape covered the artificial river completely, from one bank to the other. A building of some sort, and the golden lines appeared to be cracks in curtains that hung down to the water. The boat reached this barrier and pushed through with little trouble. Locke shoved heavy damp canvas away from his face, and as it fell aside, the boat burst into broad daylight. They were inside a walled and roofed garden, at least 40 feet high, filled with willow, witchwood, olive, citrus, and amberthorn trees. Black, brown, and grey trunks stood in ranks beside one another, their vine-tangled branches reaching up in vast constellations of bright leaves that entwined above the river like a roof beneath the roof. As for the roof itself, it was scintillant, sky-blue and bright as noon, with wisps of white clouds drifting past, half-visible between the branches. The sun burned painfully bright on Locke's right as he turned around to stare straight ahead.
and it sent rays of golden light down through the silhouetted leaves, though surely it was still the middle of the night outside.
"This is alchemy, or sorcery, or both," said Jean.
"Some alchemy," said Stragos in a soft, enthusiastic voice. "The ceiling is glass, the clouds are smoke, the sun is a burning vessel of alchemical oils and mirrors."
"Bright enough to keep this forest alive under a roof?" "Damn," said Locke.
"It may indeed be bright enough, Lamora," said the Archon, "but if you'll look closely, you'll see that nothing under this roof besides ourselves is alive."
As Locke and Jean glanced around in disbelief, Stragos steered the boat up against one of the garden's riverbanks. The waterway narrowed here to a mere 10 feet, to allow room for the trees and vines and bushes on either side. Stragos reached out to grasp a trunk and halt the boat, and he pointed into the air as he spoke.
"A clockwork garden for my clockwork river. There's not a real plant in here. It's wood and clay and wire and silk, paint and dye and alchemy. All of it engineered to my design. It took the artificers and their assistants 6 years to construct it all. My little glen of mechanisms."
Incredulously, Locke realized that the Archon was telling the truth. Other than the movement of white smoke clouds far overhead, the place was unnaturally still, almost eerie, and the air in the enclosed garden was inert, smelling of stale water and canvas. It should have been bursting with forest scents, with the rich odors of dirt and flowering and decay.
"Do I still strike you as a man farting in an enclosed room, Lamora? In here I do command the wind."
Stragos raised his right arm high above his head, and a rustling noise filled the artificial garden. A current of air plucked at Locke's scalp, and steadily rose until there was a firm breeze against his face. The leaves and branches around them swayed gently.
"And the rain!" cried Stragos.
His voice echoed off the water and was lost in the depths of the suddenly lively forest. A moment later a faint warm mist began to descend, a ticklish haze of water that swirled in ghostly curves throughout the imaginary greenery and enveloped their boat. Then drops began to fall with a soft pitter-patter, rippling the surface of the clockwork river. Locke and Jean huddled beneath their coats as Stragos laughed.
"I can do more," said Stragos. "Perhaps I can even call up a storm."
A stronger breath of air began to beat the rain and mist against them. The little river churned as a countercurrent surged from somewhere ahead of them. Little whitecaps burst beneath the boat as though the water were boiling. Stragos clung to his chosen tree trunk with both hands as the boat rocked nauseatingly. The raindrops grew heavier and harder. Locke had to shield his eyes to see. Clouds of thick, dark mist boiled overhead, dimming the artificial sun. The forest had come to life, flailing at the misty air with branches and leaves as though the faux greenery was at war with unseen ghosts.
"But only after a fashion," said Stragos, and without any apparent further signals from him, the rain faded away.
Gradually, the flailing of the forest died down to a soft rustling, and then to stillness. The surging currents of the river beneath them subsided, and in minutes the mechanical garden was restored to relative peace. Fingers of fading mist swirled around the trees, the sun peeked out from behind the thinning clouds, and the enclosure echoed with a not unpleasant sound of water dripping from a thousand branches and fronds and trunks. Locke shook himself and pushed his wet hair back out of his eyes.
It's God's damned singular, Archon. I'll give it that. I've never even imagined anything like this."
"A bottled garden with bottled weather," mused Jean.
"Why?"
Locke asked the question for both of them.
"As a reminder."
Stragos released his hold on the tree trunk and let the boat drift gently into the middle of the stream once again.
of what the hands and minds of human beings can achieve, of what this city alone in all the world is capable of producing. I told you my Mon Magisteria was a repository of artificial things. Think of them as the fruits of order. Order I must secure and safeguard. How the hell does interfering with Talvarar's ocean commerce secure and safeguard order? Short-term sacrifice for long-term gain. There is something latent in this city that will flower, Lamora. Something that will bloom. Can you imagine the wonders the Therin throne might have produced, given centuries of peace, had it not been shattered into all our warring, scrabbling city-states? Something is preparing to emerge out of all our misfortune at last, and it will be here. The alchemists and artificers of Talvarar are peerless, and the scholars of the Therin Collegium are just a few days away. It must be here.
Maxilan, darling. Locke raised one eyebrow and smiled. I knew you were driven, but I had no idea you could smoulder. Come, take me now.
Jean won't mind. He'll avert his eyes like a gentleman. Mock me as you will, Lamora, but hear the words I speak. Comprehend, damn you. What you just witnessed, said Strugos, required 60 men and women to achieve, spotters watching for my signals, alchemists to tend the smoke pots, and hidden crews to work the bellows and fans that produce the wind. There were several dozen merely pulling strings, as it were. The branches of my artificial trees are threaded with metal wire like puppets, so that they may shake more convincingly. A small army of trained workers, straining to produce a 5-minute spectacle for 3 men in a boat. And even that was not possible with the art and artifice of previous centuries. What more might we achieve, given time? What if 30 people could produce the same result, or 10, or 1? What if better devices could give stronger winds, more driving rain, a harder current? What if our mechanisms of control grew so subtle and so powerful that they ceased to be a spectacle at all? What if we could harness them to change anything, control anything, even ourselves, our bodies, our souls? We cower in the ruins of the Eldrin world, and cower in the shadow of the Magi of Carthane. But common men and women could equal their power. Given centuries, given the good grace of the gods, common men and women could eclipse their power.
And all of these grandiose notions, said Jean, somehow require the 2 of us to go out and pretend to be pirates on your behalf.
Talvarar will never be strong so long as its fate is vouchsafed by those who would squeeze gold from it like milk from a cow, then flee for the horizons at the first sign of danger. I need more power, and to speak plainly, I must seize or trick it out of my enemies with the will of the people behind me. Your mission, if successful, would turn a key in the lock of a door that bars the way to greater things.
Strugos chuckled and spread his hands.
You are thieves. I am offering you a chance to help steal history itself.
Which is of little comfort, said Locke, compared to money in a counting house and a roof over one's head.
You hate the Magi of Carthane, said Strugos flatly.
I suppose I do, said Locke.
The last emperor of the Therin throne tried to fight them with magic. Sorcery against sorcery. He died for his failure. Carthane can never be conquered by the arts it commands. They have ensured that no power in our world will ever have sorcerers numerous or powerful enough to match them. They must be fought with this.
He set down his oar and spread his hands.
Machines. Artifice, alchemy and engineering, the fruits of the mind.
All of this, said Locke,
this whole ridiculous scheme. A more powerful Tal'Varar conquering this corner of the world, all to hurt Carthane? I can't say I find the idea unpleasant, but why? What did they do to you to make you imagine this? Do either of you know, said Stragos, of the ancient art of illusionism? Have you ever read about it in books of history?
A little, said Locke.
Not very much. Once upon a time, the performance of illusions, imaginary magic, not real sorcery at all, just clever tricks, was widespread, popular, and lucrative. Commoners paid to see it on street corners. Nobles of the Therin throne paid to see it in their courts. But that culture is dead. The art no longer exists, except as trifles for card sharps. The bonds magi haunt our city-states like wolves, ready to crush the slightest hint of competition. No sensible person would ever stand up in public and declare themselves to be capable of magic. Fear killed the entire tradition hundreds of years ago. The bonds magi distort our world with their very presence. They rule us in many ways that have nothing to do with politics. The fact that we can hire them to do our bidding is immaterial. That little guild looms over everything we plan, everything we dream. Fear of the Magi poisons our people to the very marrow of their ambitions. It prevents them from imagining a larger destiny, from the hope of reforging the empire we once had. I know that you consider what I've done to you unforgivable, but believe it or not, I admire you for standing up to the bonds, Magi. They turned you over to me as a means of punishment. Instead, I ask you to help me strike at them.
Grand abstracts, said Jean. You make it sound like this is some sort of incredible privilege for us, being pressed into service without our consent.
I don't need an excuse to hate the bonds, Magi, said Locke. Not to hate them, nor to fight them. I've taunted them to their faces, more or less, Jean and I both. But you have to be some kind of madman to think they'll ever let you build anything openly powerful enough to knock them down.
I don't expect to live to see it, said Stragos. I only expect to plant the seed. Look at the world around you, Lamora. Examine the clues they've given us. Alchemy is revered in every corner of our world, is it not? It lights our rooms, salves our injuries, preserves our food, enhances our cider. He favored Locke and Jean with a self-satisfied smile. Alchemy is a low-grade form of magic, but the bonds magi have never once tried to curtail or control it.
Because they just don't give a damn, said Locke.
Wrong, said Stragos, because it's so necessary to so many things. It would be like trying to deny us the right to water or fire. It would push us too far. No matter the cost, no matter the carnage, it would force us to fight back against them for the sake of our very existence. And they know it. Their power has limits. Some day we'll surpass those limits, if we're only given a chance.
That's a fine bedtime story, said Locke. If you wrote a book on that subject, I'd pay for 10 copies to be scribed. But here and now, you're interfering with our lives. You're tearing us away from something we've worked long and hard to achieve.
I am prepared to expand on my earlier terms, said Stragos, and offer a financial reward for the successful completion of your task.
How much? Said Locke and Jean simultaneously.
No promises, said Stragos. Your reward will be proportional to your achievement. I shall make you as happy as you make me. Is that understood?
Locke stared at Stragos for several seconds, scratching his neck. Stragos was using a confidence trick, an appeal to high ideals followed by an appeal to greed. And this was a classic fuck-the-agent situation. Stragos had no compulsion whatsoever to follow through on his promise,
and nothing to lose by making it, and no reason at all to let him and Jean live once their task was finished. He made eye contact with Jean and stroked his chin several times, a simple hand signal. Lying. Jean sighed and tapped his fingers a few times against the gunwale on his side of the boat. He seemed to share Locke's thought that elaborate signals would best be avoided with Stragos just a few feet away. His answer was equally simple. Agreed. That's good news, said Locke, conjuring a note of guarded optimism in his voice. The knowledge that he and Jean were of one mind always gave him renewed energy for false facing. A pile of Solari when this is all over would go a long way toward mitigating our distaste for the circumstances of our employment. Good. My sole concern is that the mission may benefit from more enthusiasm on your part. This mission, to be frank, is going to need all the help it can get. Don't dwell on the matter, Lamora. And look out behind. We're coming to the far side of my little glen. The boat was sliding toward another curtain barrier of hanging canvas. By Locke's casual estimate, the entire artificial garden enclosure must have been about 80 yards long. "Say farewell to the sun," said the Archon, and then they were slipping through the canvas, back out into the muggy black and silver night, with its flitting lantern flies and genuine forest perfume. A guard dog barked nearby, growled, and went silent in response to a hushed command. Locke rubbed his eyes as they slowly adjusted once again to the darkness. "You'll begin training this week," said Stragos. "What do you mean, training? There's a pile of questions you haven't answered," said Locke. "Where's our ship? Where's our crew? How do we make ourselves known as pirates? There's 1,000 damn details to go over." "All in good time," said Stragos. His voice had an air of unmistakable satisfaction, now that Locke was speaking constructively of carrying out his plan. "I'm told you two frequently take meals at the Gilded Cloister. Spend a few days returning to a schedule of rising with the sun. On Thrones Day, have breakfast at the Cloister. Wait for Meraine to find you. She'll see you to your destination with her usual discretion, and you'll begin your lessons. They'll take up most of your days, so don't make any plans."
"Damn it," said Jean. "Why not let us finish our affair with Requin? It won't take more than a few weeks. Then we can do whatever you like without distraction."
"I've thought about it," said Stragos. "But no. Postpone it. I want you to have something to look forward to after you complete my mission. And I don't have a few weeks to wait. I need you at sea in a month. 6 weeks at the very latest."
"A month to go from gratefully ignorant landlubbers to fucking professional pirates?" said Jean. "Gods!"
"It will be a busy month," said Stragos. Locke groaned. "Are you up for the task? Or shall I simply deny you your antidote and give you a prison cell from which to observe the results?"
"Just see to it that the fucking antidote is ready and waiting each time we come back," said Locke,
"and give a serious ponder to just how much money would best send us away happy when this affair is concluded. I'm guessing that you're likely to be the underestimating type in that regard, so I'd think big."
"Rewards proportional to results, Lamora. That and your lives. When the red flag is seen again in my city's waters, and the Priori are begging me to save them, you may turn your thoughts to the matter of reward. Then and no sooner. Understood?"
"Lying," Locke signaled to Jean. Sure it was unnecessary, but equally sure Jean would appreciate a bit of cheek.
"Your will, then, I suppose. If the gods are kind, we'll poke a stick into whatever hornet's nest is left to be stirred up down in the ghost winds. After all, we have no choice, do we?"
"As it should be," said Stragos.
"You know, Locke," said Jean in a lightly conversational tone of voice,
I like to imagine that there are thieves out there who only ever get caught up in perfectly ordinary, uncomplicated escapades. We should consider finding some and asking them what their secret is one of these days.
It's probably as simple as staying the hell away from assholes like this, said Locke, gesturing at the Archon.
4. A squad of eyes was waiting beside the boathouse when the little craft completed its circuit of the artificial river.
Here, said Stragos, after one of his soldiers took the oar from him.
He removed 2 glass vials from his pockets and held one out to each Komori thief.
Your first stay of execution. The poison's had time to work its way into you. I don't want to have to worry about you for the next few weeks.
Locke and Jean complied, each gagging as they drank.
Tastes like chalk, said Locke, wiping his mouth.
If only it were that inexpensive, said the Archon. Now give the vials back. Caps too.
Locke sighed. I suppose it was too much to hope you'd forget that part. The 2 thieves were being hauled back toward the Mon Magisteria as Stragos lashed the boat to the piling once again. Stragos stood up, stretched, and felt the old familiar creaks, the twinges in his hips and knees and wrists. Damn rheumatism. By rights he was still outrunning his age, still ahead of most men nearing 60 years, but he knew deep in his heart that there would never be any way of running fast enough. Sooner or later, the Lady of the Long Silence would call a dance for Maxillan Stragos, whether or not his work here was done. Meraine was waiting in the shadows of the unlit side of the boathouse, still and quiet as a hunting spider until she stepped out beside him. Long practice enabled him to avoid flinching.
My thanks for saving those 2, Meraine. You've been very useful to me these past few weeks.
Just as I was instructed to be, she said. But are you sure they really suit the needs of this plan of yours?
They're at every disadvantage in this city, my dear.
Stragos squinted at the blurry forms of Locke, Jean, and their escorts as they disappeared into the garden.
The bonds magi sewed them up for us, and we have them second-guessing their every step. I don't believe those 2 are used to being controlled. Out on their own, I know they'll perform as required.
Your reports give you that much confidence?
Not merely my reports, said Stragos. Requin certainly hasn't killed them yet, has he?
I suppose not.
They'll serve, said Stragos. I know their hearts. As the days go by, the resentment will fade, and the novelty will gain on them. They'll be enjoying themselves soon enough, and when they start to enjoy themselves, I honestly think they can do it, if they live. It's for damn sure I've no other agents suitable to the task.
Then I may report to my masters that the plan is underway?
Yes, I suppose this commits us. You may do just that.
Stragos eyed the shadowed shape of the slender woman beside him and sighed.
Let them know that everything begins in a month or so. I hope for their sake they're ready for the consequences.
Nobody's ready for the consequences, said Meraine. It's going to mean more blood than anyone's seen in 200 years. All we can do is hope that by sitting things off we can ensure that others reap most of the trouble. By your leave, Archon, I'd like to go compose my messages to them now.
Of course, said Stragos. Send my regards along with your report, and my prayers that we might continue to prosper together.
Last Reminiscence, by their own rope. 1.
Oh, this is a wonderful spot to fling ourselves to our deaths from, said Locke. 6 months had passed since his return from Salon Corbeau.
The suite of 4 exquisitely crafted chairs was safely locked away in a private storage room at the Villa Candessa. Talvara's version of late winter held the region in the grip of temperatures so brisk that folk had to engage in actual labor to break a sweat. About an hour's hard ride north of Talvara, just past the village of Vo Samara and its surrounding fields, a scrubby forest of gnarled witchwood and amberthorn trees rose beside a wide, rocky vale. The walls of this vale were the greyish color of corpse flesh, giving the place the look of a giant wound in the earth. The thin, olive-colored grass abandoned the struggle for life about 10 feet from the edge of the cliffs above this vale, where Locke and Jean stood contemplating the sheer 100-foot drop to the gravel floor far below.
"I suppose we should have kept more in practice with this," said Jean, starting to shrug his way out of the half-dozen coils of rope draped from his right shoulder to his left hip. "But then I don't recall many opportunities to put it to use in the past few years."
"Most places in Camor we could just hand over hand it up and down," said Locke. "I don't think you were even with us that night we used ropes to get up Lady Damar's tower of that horrible old estate of hers. Carlo and Galdo and I nearly got pecked to bloody shreds by pigeons working that one. Must have been 5-6 years ago."
"Oh, I was with you, remember? On the ground, keeping watch. I saw the bit with the pigeons. Hard to play sentry when you're pissing yourself laughing.
Wasn't funny at all from up top. Beaky little bastards were vicious."
"The death of 1,000 pecks, said Jean. "You would have been legends, dying so gruesomely. I'd have written a book on the man-eating pigeons of Camor and joined the Therin Collegium. Gone respectable. Bug and I would have built a memorial statue to the Sansas with a nice plaque."
"What about me?"
"Footnote on the plaque, space permitting.
Hand over some rope or I'll show you the edge of the cliff, space permitting."
Jean tossed a coil to Locke, who plucked it out of the air and walked back toward the edge of the forest, about 30 feet from the cliff. The rope was tightly woven demi-silk, much lighter than hemp and much more expensive. At the rim of the forest, Locke selected a tall old witchwood, about as broad around as Jean's shoulders. He pulled a goodly length of his line free, passed it around the tree trunk, and stared at the slightly frayed end for a few seconds, trying to rekindle his memories of knot-tying. As his fingers slipped into hesitant motion, he took a quick glance around at the melancholy state of the world. A stiff wind was blowing from the northwest, and the sky was one vast cataract of wet-looking haze. Their hired carriage was parked at the far end of the woods, perhaps 300 yards away. He and Jean had set the driver up with a clay jug of beer and a splendid basket lunch from the Villa Candessa, promising to be gone for a few hours at most.
"Jean," muttered Locke as the bigger man stepped up beside him, "this is a proper anchor noose, right?"
"Certainly looks like it."
Jean hefted the elaborate knot that secured the rope in a bite around the tree and nodded. He took the working end of the rope and added an additional half-hitch for safety.
"There, just right."
He and Locke worked together for a few minutes, repeating the anchor-noose knot with 3 further lengths of rope, until the old witchwood tree seemed thoroughly decorated with taut demi-silk. Their spare coils of rope were set aside. The 2 men then slipped out of their long frock coats and their vests, revealing heavy leather belts studded with iron rings at their waists. The belts weren't quite like the custom climbing harnesses treasured by the more responsible burglars of Camor. These were actually nautical in origin, used by those happy sailors whose ship owners cared enough to spend a bit of money to preserve their health. The belts had been available on the cheap, and had spared Locke and Jean the need to suss out a contact in Talvara's underworld who could make a pair to order. But remember the transaction. There were a few things Requin would be better off not knowing until the chance came to finally spring the game on him.
"Right then, here's your descender."
Jean passed Locke a fairly heavy bit of iron, a figure 8 with one side larger than the other, with a thick bar right down the middle.
He also kept one for himself. He'd had them knocked up by a blacksmith in Talvarar's Istrian Crescent a few weeks earlier.
"Let's get you rigged up first. Mainline, then belay."
Locke clipped his descender into one of his harness rings and threaded it through with one of the demi-silk lines leading back to the tree. The other end of this line was left free and tossed toward the cliff. A second line was lashed tight to a harness ring above Locke's opposite hip. Many Camorri thieves on working jobs danced naked without the added safety of a belay line in case their primary rope broke. But for today's practice session, Locke and Jean were in firm agreement that they were going to play it safe and boring. It took a few minutes to rig Jean up in a similar fashion. Soon enough, they were each attached to the tree by two lines, like a pair of human puppets. The two thieves wore little save their tunics, breeches, field boots, and leather gloves, though Jean did pause to slip his reading optics on.
"Now then," he said, "seems a fine day for abseiling. Care to do the honours before we kiss solid earth farewell?"
"Crooked warden," said Locke, "men are stupid. Protect us from ourselves. If you can't, let it be quick and painless."
"Well said." Jean took a deep breath. "Crazy part on three?"
"On three." Each of them took up their coiled main line and tossed the free end over the cliff. The two ropes went over and uncoiled with a soft hiss.
"One," said Locke.
"Two," said Jean.
"Three," they said together. Then they ran for the cliff and threw themselves off, whooping as they went.
For one brief moment, Locke's stomach and the misty grey sky seemed to be turning a somersault in unison. Then his line was taut and the cliff face was rushing toward him just a little too eagerly for his taste. Like a human pendulum, he swung in, raised his legs, and hit the rock wall about 8 feet beneath the rim, keeping his knees bent to absorb the shock of impact. That much, at least, he remembered very well. Jean hit with a heavier whoomp about 2 feet below him.
"Heh!"
said Locke, his heartbeat pounding in his ears, loud enough to match the whisper of the wind.
"There's got to be an easier way to test whether or not we have an honest rope weaver, Jean."
"Phew!" Jean shifted his feet slightly, keeping a hold on his line with both hands. The use of the descenders made it easy for them to apply enough friction to the rope to slow or stop at will. The little devices were a marked improvement on what they'd been taught as boys. While they could still no doubt slide down a rope using their own bodies for friction, as they once had, it was easy to abrade a certain protruding portion of the male anatomy with that approach if one was careless or unlucky. For a few moments they simply hung there, feet against the cliffside, enjoying their new vantage point as the vaporous clouds rolled by overhead. The ropes waving in the air beneath them only hung down about half the distance to the ground, but they didn't intend to get there today anyway. There would be plenty of time to work up to longer drops in future practice sessions.
"You know," said Locke, "this is the only part of the plan I must admit that I wasn't terribly sure of. It's so much easier to contemplate abseiling from a height like this than it is to actually run off a cliff with just two lengths of rope between you and Azaguia."
"Ropes and cliffs are no problem," said Jean. "What we need to watch out for up here are your carnivorous pigeons."
"Oh, bend over and bite your own ass."
"I'm serious. I'm terrified. I'll keep a sharp lookout, lest the last thing we feel in this life should be that terrible swift pecking."
"Jean, your belay line must be weighing you down. Here, let me cut it for you."
They kicked and shoved good-naturedly against one another for a few minutes, Locke scrambling around and trying to use his agility to balance out Jean's far greater strength and mass. Strength and mass seemed to be winning the day, however, so in a fit of self-preservation he suggested they actually practice descending.
"Sure," said Jean. "Let's go down 5 or 6 feet, nice and smooth, and stop on my mark, shall we?"
Each of them gripped his taut main line and released a bit of tension on his descender. Slowly, smoothly, they slipped down a good 2 yards, and Jean cried, "Hold!"
"Not bad," said Locke. "The knack seems to come back quick, doesn't it?"
"I suppose. I was never really keen on this after I got back from my little holiday at Revelation House. This was more your thing, and the Sansa's than mine. And, Sabatha's, of course."
"Yeah," said Locke wistfully. "Yeah, she was so mad. So mad and so lovely. I used to love watching her climb. She didn't like ropes. She'd take her boots off and let her hair out and wouldn't even wear gloves sometimes. Just her breeches and her blouse, and I would just..."
"Sit there hypnotized," said Jean, struck dumb. "Hey, my eyes worked back then too, Locke."
"Heh, I suppose it must have been obvious. Gods."
Locke stared at Jean and laughed nervously.
"Gods, I'm actually bringing her up myself. I don't believe it."
His expression turned shrewd. "Are we all right with each other, Jean? Back to being comfortable, I mean."
"Hell, we're hanging together 80 feet above a messy death, aren't we? I don't do that with people I don't like."
"That's good to hear."
"And, yeah, I'd say we're..."
"Gentlemen, hello down there!"
The voice was Ferrari, with a rough, rustic edge. Locke and Jean glanced up in surprise and saw a man standing at the edge of the cliff, arms akimbo, silhouetted against the churning sky. He wore a threadbare cloak with the hood thrown up.
"Hello up there," said Locke.
"Fine day for a bit of sport, ain't it?"
"That's exactly what we thought," cried Jean.
"A fine day indeed, begging your pardon, sirs, and a fine set of coats and vests you've gone and left up here. I like them very much, excepting that there ain't no per-"